knew from the beginning, they're multiple episode kids. We're basically averaging about 8 to 10 per month. I looked at the annual figure for this year in December, and we had 78 girls through the system at that point. I think the thing that really jumps out every time I look at these numbers, and it's been repeated every single time, is over half of those girls are under age 15, and a half to two-thirds of those girls are kids of color. You just heard a report from the communities of color, and this is definitely a disproportionate issue that's affecting these communities, which is why the services are so crucial. So our job is to get them off of the street, provide the safety. We get them hooked up with SARC. You'll see a number of the girls that leave on unplanned exits. That's part of the plan, as we know they're going to do that. But I always look at the second piece of data, which is every girl who was in the program left with a SARC advocate. So if they're there even for a day and we can get that connection made, then that advocate is with them for as many years as it's going to take. And if you look at the data beyond that, you'll see that SARC is making hundreds of contacts and massive amounts of hours that they're spending with these girls every month based on the advocacy you're providing for them. So I always say this is a place where I am proud to be a part of a group like this in a community like this addressing this, and I'm really sad and angry at some point that we even have to still do this. But the fact is we're doing it, other places aren't, and the city's investment is crucial. Also, last piece, that your investment leverages back into the county system, because Multnomah County then used money to fund a long-term shelter, which we opened December of this past year. So that when the girls leave this program or come in from other places and they need a stable living environment, we now have a 7-bed residential program. So by the city stepping up and taking the emergency shelter piece on, that allowed the county to come in with its resources and do the long term. And they actually have about $300,000 to $350,000 in on their match on this as well. So I think it's an institutional partnership here that's working really well too.
So the long term shelter started in
December. Just last year. I mean, just, yeah, 3 months ago.
And how many? Seven
beds? Seven beds, right. We don't know.
The Janus, are you providing that too?
Yeah. And actually, we opened that one so fast that we had staff hired and were ready to open before the fingerprints cleared in Salem, so we had to delay the opening until the system caught up with us. But, yeah, we've got kids coming into that as we speak.
Could you talk to me some more about the follow-up with more than half the girls leaving unplanned? What is the follow-up?
The deal is that's the design of the system with involving SARC in that process, because these girls, they're a very difficult population to work with, and they end up feeling more comfortable on the street and back with their pimp. And so we make that connection with SARC so that way those individuals have 24-hour access to these children, and they call them on a regular basis, and they work with these kids to get them back in shelter. As Dennis said, we've seen a total of about 41 unduplicated kids this year, with duplication being 64. So a high number of those kids have come back through our facility time and time again.
And so for the 23 that are left, do we have statistics on how they respond to the follow-up? Do they stay connected with their SARC?
They do. Okay. They do. They stay strongly connected to their SARC advocate. And their advocate on a regular basis, they're called out 24/7 into Harry's mother, and they routinely, every day if not every other day, are transporting girls back to us. And they may not enter shelter. This number is just for young girls that have entered shelter.
Right.
They may bring them back for some immediate assistance. It might be medical care, counseling, crisis intervention, meeting with a police officer in our agency.
It'll take more time to see what that long-term outcome is.
Yes, yes. This is a very difficult population to work with. You probably read the Sunday Oregonian. There was a large article in there about a pimp being prosecuted, and extensive information in there. And I included the article in this packet of the connection that these young children have with their pimp. And I know a lot of us don't understand that relationship, but for a child, that's an important relationship at that point in time, and it's difficult to break through that.
Right. And I appreciate you using the word child, and I specifically use the word girl rather than young woman.
Yeah.
You're 13 years old.
Yeah.
Yes.
You're a child.
Yeah.
And the SARC philosophy is once they open a case, it's open forever. So they have cases that go back 3+ years. And this is the way the system was designed in our initial planning to go 3 years or more. So basically as long as it takes to stay with the girl, but also to accommodate multiple episodes, because we know they're going to be in the shelter, be safe for a period of time, they're going to run back, hit the pimp, they're going to go to Las Vegas, disappear for 6 months, they show back up. SARC networks with other agencies around the country that even help transport the girls safely from here to there or from there to here when that happens. But the basic concept is we're not going to shame or blame you. A traditional program, you get into trouble when you leave. This program, the assumption is you're going to be safe when you come back. And our goal is to keep offering more and more safety, and hopefully that stay extends and they finally bite into something that will work with them.
And establishing that personal relationship with the particular.
That is the key thing, and that's why that relates. And that's also why, if you see with the child welfare, almost all of these girls, virtually universally, when you cross caseloads, child welfare will have a case on all of these kids at some point. Well, they've established their own unit, again, which is unique nationally. But that means if a girl leaves Oregon, comes back 3 months, 6 months, a year later, she's going to the same thing, find the same child welfare worker. So she's not going to get a new caseworker, a new intake, and start the whole system blind all over. So we're trying as much as possible to have them come back to always the same shelter, same SARC worker, same child welfare worker. They see the same police officers on the street. We work really closely with the police on this stuff. And I think that's going to be long-term the success of the system, is if we can get them building trust with somebody.
And I have to admit, when we first started talking about this particular approach, it's sort of your heart is in your throat with the notion that you develop a system that isn't based on efforts of the past where you lock girls up until they become adults. And then, you know, even if you can, and then expect that somehow magically it's all taken care of. And so you convinced me it is, that approach doesn't work, and this approach does, especially given the modest resources we have to devote to it.
Mm-hmm.
And especially that last part where they and or their pimp can leave the state and do all the time, and that there is really trying to win over the heart and the mind of the victim.
Yeah, one of the things that we see, we're unique in that we operate in Washington also, and we have the only emergency shelters in Southwest Washington until you hit Tacoma, so that entire six-county region. And we have seen over the past year an increase in the number of girls that we're taking in. We had 27 girls in Vancouver shelters that were I self-identified as being sex trafficked. But what we're beginning to hear anecdotally is the pimps are now moving their kids over to that side of the river because Portland has such a sophisticated system for identifying and supporting them. So we're trying to get similar. We have no resources in Vancouver outside of our shelters at this point, but we're really advocating in that community. Just like we have to keep the laws equal, we also need to get some resources over there because we don't want to make it easier to be in one place or the other. But it does tell you something's happening because the pimps see this as a business, and it means at least at some level their business is getting interfered with. So we're doing something right on that level. But we need to have a regional approach on this. This is just like the bridge. We got to have, if we don't take care of both sides of it, they just run back and forth.
And the police chief and I gathered together with mayors up and down I-5 and I-84 and police chiefs. We had representation all the way to Vancouver, British Columbia. The mayor of Seattle was here. The mayor of Vancouver, Washington was here to put together that sort of big regional approach. We got a ways to go, but it's on our radar screen. We're working on it.
Mayor, do we have staff here today?
From
staffing this? I mean, do we have the... the grant manager here just asked some questions.
Amarit? I work through Amarit.
Yeah, this is my office.
I had a couple questions about the ordinance. I don't know if it goes to these gentlemen or to whoever.
Why don't you see if I can answer them, or we'll bring in certified smart people who can, or maybe our friends from the county can, because you also manage this with us.
There's just some wordsmith in the ordinance I don't understand. It says that in paragraph 6, an additional $113,000 in funding is necessary. And it goes on to say that it's an emergency because budget cycles because of the problem. And I don't understand why is this an additional allocation if the ordinance also says we've already appropriated this?
I think that's the boilerplate language that we use. When the amount is different than what was budgeted, in this case less. This was in the last adopted budget for the city, so it's not
new money, it's less.
Right.
Okay, and then, so what's the total amount we will, we had a prior resolution 36824 where we dedicated $285,000 to the shelter.
Right.
What's then the total amount we're spending on operations?
On a yearly basis, it's going to be about $247,000. The additional amount, that $40,000 plus, was for some facility and structural upgrades for safety reasons around our shelter with surveillance systems and things like that. But the ongoing costs for the SARC advocates, the additional overnight staff at Janus, and some transportation and cell phone costs in there, along with benefits and stuff like that, is about $247,000 on an annual basis.
So according to the grant agreement, it looks like that you will likely be making a request for 12-13 for continued funding. Is that correct?
Yes. Correct. Right.
And well, so
I will be.
As we do that, what'll be, I think, important for us is to have a sense of what do you project as the, what are your goals for the next fiscal year, number of people you're going to serve, and okay. outcomes.
Right. Yeah.
And then we can compare that with how we've done in year one okay. and have a sense, because this is this has a slightly different project management component than how we do our other shelter services that mm-hmm. are administered
right.
through the Housing Bureau. So
yes.
could we get some data along those mm. lines, both that sort of clearer sense of how year one has gone and what your targets are for year two, so we can have that data as we deliberate.
Yes,
on the,
yeah,
on the
and we will have the data now. The first time through, we were literally shooting in the dark because this yeah. had never been done, and we don't have any baseline to operate from, but we're creating that baseline, and I think.
And I think if you're willing, Commissioner, to have this appropriated and managed by the Housing Bureau or the Police Bureau, either one would be great.
We'd be happy to bring, I mean, we administer all the other grants,
right.
I guess, for shelter services.
Right.
Dennis, I'd be remiss if we didn't use this opportunity to acknowledge that, particularly with Mary here, that, you know, as we talk about who does what, county and city, it's discussions like this that I think highlight that the old Resolution A, division of labor, no longer has currency. I mean, in a perfect world, we'd say, okay, what does Resolution A say we do, and what does the county do? And we'd say, okay, do just what you're supposed to do. But we don't live in a perfect world. And with the color of money, with the cuts, with the growing need, the only way we're going to address this problem is by city and county working together. But then when we do that, we're told by auditors and editorial boards that we've strayed from Resolution A. And I guess I know the mayor agrees with this, but I think this really begs the question, let's go back and take a look at Resolution A. There may be some things that the city should take on entirely, and there may be a different allocation of work. But increasingly, the reality is that it's both. We jointly fund. And when you look at the old bifurcation, it just doesn't make a lot of sense. And why stand on ceremony when the question is, what's the need and how do you fund it, versus what does an old document tell us should be the allocation of resources?
Yes, and I think the intersection, because we sit at the cusp of most of those intersections with city and county, is around these emergency and housing services. And I think, yeah, I'm definitely with you that the theory and the reality is two different worlds. And if you didn't have both city and county working together, you would not be able to either get the resources or get the planning or get the support, because, again, this is not just county. This is also police. If the Police Bureau is not locked into this as a partner, it's not going to happen. So,
well, I guess the other piece of it is the people we serve could care less who mm-hmm. is funding it. Yes. What they care about is that we're making progress towards solving the problem.
Yeah.
And I don't, you know, I've never had someone stop me in the street and saying, why are you funding a county responsibility? They complain about the libraries, and I always... No, I'm kidding. Whenever they complain about things outside of my, I'm perfectly happy to send them to Commissioner
Bridges,
Leonard's office.
Bridges,
but I think the public expects us to work together to solve these problems, and it just adds another level of urgency to go back and take a look at those Resolution A lines.
Before you do, I think you'll be pleased with. In about 45 days, we'll be ready to have that very discussion. Chair Kogan and I have been working on something for our groups, boards, and council to consider. The other thing along those lines is, as the council knows, but to those listening, is we've got joint budgeting going on in public safety that goes even beyond the county and including TriMet and the port and other public safety. Folks that do public safety in the 146 square miles of the boundary of Portland. We're doing the same in transportation and economic development and job creation. So I think your points are right on point.
You could add, I think, housing to that. Since effectively what we're doing now on homeless services is tracking a unitary stream of dollars and then figuring out how we allocate them. But it's maybe not as formalized. So thank you.
Commissioner Seltzman?
Yeah, and I would just parenthetically add on the Children's Levy Allocation Committee is a standing seat for a county commissioner. Mm-hmm. So you've mentioned that most of the women, girls, have child welfare involvement. Does that mean they're in foster care when they arrive, technically in foster care?
They may not be in the state's custody, but the state is aware of the child. And the child may have been in custody in previous years, but may not be currently. I would have to go back and look through to see how many are actively in foster care. If I had to make an estimate, I would probably say about half are in foster care where the state has custody of them. The other half, the state knows about them. They've had child abuse reports on them. They've had incident reports taken on them, but they may not be in the custody of the state.
And child welfare workers are integrally involved in services, service planning?
They are. DHS created a division within Multnomah County specific to the CSAC population, and those workers operate on a little bit different of a standard, those caseworkers, than a typical DHS caseworker, where they're called out outside of the 9 to 5 hours. They make regular visits with these youth. If the youth come into our facility, the DHS worker makes it a point to come down there and make contact with this young person, because they understand that relationship is so important.
Okay. Yeah. So there's no arm's length. You can't. You have to stay outside. I'm literally speaking.
But yeah. No.
Yeah.
No. If when we have,
because I know some of the youth shelters have sort of that relationship with the police. You know, you can't come in the shelter, but
yeah. No. Our office, any given time during the day, there will be SARC advocates in there, DHS workers in there, police officers in there. It's really a community combination and a hub where people can come and meet with these youth when they're in shelter.
Okay. And my final question, and you can do this in an email to me too. I'm just curious what kind of stuff you ask upon intake, and maybe you can email me an intake form or something.
Sure.
Okay.
Sort of why they're there and how they got there.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm just curious what information you ask, you know, medical information, things like that. So I assume you have a form.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. I can provide.
You can just email it to me.
I can provide you that information. Now, I do want to add one.
Mary, could you come up just a second?
One little thing here with the police bureau. I saw on the news last night a meeting that occurred, a community meeting. I cannot say enough wonderful things about the police bureau and how they react with this population. They are committed, concerned. If we need to call, which is not uncommon, for police intervention, there are multiple officers there, and they work closely with our staff, and they're truly phenomenal in the work that they do with this population.
So I think it's important to the larger dialogue outside of this room has included newspaper stories that question whether this was really a problem at all in the city. And so I wanted we weren't as coordinated before. So the verifiable data wasn't there for us to say to the reporter or others, you're wrong. But now that we have some experience with this, I would like to hear your point of view, because we have competition for money, a lot of competition for money, and this is a horrible crime, but there's lots of horrible things going on out there. Is juvenile sex trafficking, commercial exploitation, is it a real problem in the city? Is this a worthy investment for the city council and the county board?
Mm-hmm. Mary Lee, Multnomah County. You know, I can't make a comment on where does this sit in the priority list of everything else. And you know that we work very closely with Commissioner Fish's bureau and a number of your bureaus on issues of concern. I think it comes down to frankly, a self-reflection on each one of our parts, whether we're in an elected office or within the bureaucracy or in the community, about how we would define the common good in this community. And are we a community that says, for however many girls who are experiencing this kind of abuse, we say no. We say, will we respond? We say we will put the resources forward that is necessary to help protect and heal and serve this population, or are we a community that accepts it as a daily fact of life? And I think there are a number of questions that go to what is our definition of the common good, and how do we define ourselves as a community in terms of, you know, who we care for, how we respond, and what we stand for. This issue, I believe, is one of them, And again, as you see, and you know, come back to your comments earlier, Mayor, about verifiable facts. We know on an intuitive level what is happening here. The workers in these organizations and everyone involved in the system know what is happening at an intuitive level. The more we look, the more we learn, the better data we get. And we will, in the end, come forward with this data. But the lack of data shouldn't prevent our action on this for what we know to be true and what we want to say about ourselves and the common good.
So is it, in your professional opinion, based on the early data, is this a problem in the city?
Absolutely. Absolutely, 100%. And I will take a personal aside to say that what we're doing here is incredible work. And it is based on our relationships that we've learned over many years with the homeless youth system, with the anti-poverty system, with our housing system. But there is another side to this issue that none of us has looked at and we must, which is the demand side. These girls are not prostituting themselves. There are men with money paying for sex with children. These are men in our community. There's money involved. It is an economic issue. It is a demand side issue. And until we as a community, again, are ready to face the demand side of what's going on here, you eliminate the demand, you eliminate the provision of these children. And we must look at that along with looking at the victim side of it.
And do you concur, is this a real problem for the city that we should be looking at, and all of us, including the media?
Absolutely. I think of it this way. I've got a 14 and a 15-year-old daughter. And when they were 13 and 14, we started this program. The average age of recruitment is 12 to 14. We've had 12-year-old girls in the shelter in Vancouver. We had an 11-year-old girl who was being pimped out by her parents from the age of 5. To support their drug habits. Now, to me, I'm with Mary, as a community, isn't one of those too many. But oftentimes what I get into in public presentations, and somebody will say, well, is Portland the number two hub? I think they are, I think they aren't. And you know what? I'm not arguing about whether we're one or two. If we're on the list to be arguing about it, there is something wrong. And what we know is 100 girls, virtually 100 girls, have gone through our emergency shelter in the last year. And we know that the police will tell you they deal with about an average of at least 200 that they see that are victims or vulnerable. Some of these are overlapping. So we know somewhere between 100 and 300 young women, children, are victims. And I think that makes it a community issue. And I don't care if we're number 1, 2, 5, or 7. I'd a lot rather be known for our bike paths than our sex trafficking.
Do you agree?
Yeah, I would agree. The toll it takes on, and the interesting thing in this article, the pimp pleaded out the case before it went to the jury's decision, and there was a small paragraph in there that talked about when the jury came back in and the judge told them they were dismissed, the jury was traumatized, and they had to sit with the defender and the prosecutor and everybody else to talk about what's going on here, what happened. And the thing I took away from that is that's my staff every day. Because I walked through our center just the other day, a young girl was taken out of a hotel room naked with an adult man, and she was brought into our office, and she looked like she was 10, clutching a little teddy bear on the couch. And I see that too often, and it's painful to see.
Thank you both, for all of you, very much. And I also want to, before you leave, to thank the Police Bureau, who gave one of the best reports on this issue at our regional summit that really ratcheted up the priority scale for cities up and down I-5 and east on I-84. I also want to thank the Seasons of Service and the Community of Faith who came forward and helped us with cash to help furnish the shelters and help pay for things. That was amazing, the Plow organization and more. So thank you.
Thank you.
How many people have signed up?
No one else signed up.
Does anyone wish to testify? All right. Can you please call the vote?
Fritz?
Well, thank you, each one, for being here. And thank you, Mayor Adams, for putting this on the regular agenda. Often contracts are done on consent, but we need to keep talking about this, as painful as it is. And I truly appreciated your comment about the workers. It must be extremely painful to be dealing with this day after day. And I want you to take back that the council cares and that we appreciate the work that the staff are doing, that each child is doing, whether they're there for one day or keep coming back. That is difficult work, escaping from a life of torture and And slavery is, and when you're trying to do it when you're 12 years old, it's not something that we want in our community. Thank you for raising the issue of demand. Having sex with children is wrong. And can we, you know, it would seem like it's taken us a while to get around to even that. But indeed it is. So I'm very proud to be on this council, to be allocating this money, the best practices that are being developed, because there are stunningly few facilities like this nationwide. And so using the personal-based approach of we don't give up, we understand that a child may be in and out and that we provide them with those relationships, that's going to help eventually and hopefully soon for at least one child today. And in meanwhile, I agree. Thank you to the police office. Thank you to the community patrols that help keep our neighborhood safe. There's a lot of work to do. Thank you for being part of it. Aye.
Fish?
I'm pleased to support this matter, and I want to thank publicly Dennis Morrow and Janice Youth for all the work they do for our city, providing shelter spaces, outreach to young people on the streets, even a community gardener, too. And we appreciate all the very different ways that you help make Portland a better place. And I thank the mayor and Commissioner Fritz for their leadership on this item.
Saltzman.
Excuse me, Saltzman. Aye.
Credit where credit's due.
Saltzman.
Well, you're doing great work, and I just, when we talk about the demand side of the equation, I can't help but note in that Sunday Oregonian article, the emergency room physician who lives in the Pearl District, who used this woman several times, from what I read in the article, it sounds like he's going to skate because, A, he's an emergency room doctor, B, he was totally honest about what he did, and, C, I'm sure he has a great attorney. So, it's unfortunate that somebody, because they of those three factors, can simply skate away from this issue. So it is appallingly real, and I appreciate all the work that you do. And I also wanted to just particularly thank County Commissioner Diane McKeel, who's been a leader on this issue from the day she took office, and is also, I believe, on the verge of getting a bill through the legislature that will expunge prostitution from young women's records. I was dubious about getting something like this through a February session, a one-month session, but it passed the House unanimously, so I'm assuming it's going to be on its way to the governor, and hopefully. So I want to thank her for all her work, too. Aye.
Leonard.
Thank you. Aye.
Adams.
I forgot to mention the Suff Morris. Also have been great on this issue and a number of other community-based organizations in addition to the Community of Faith. Big thanks. In my office, Antoinette Edwards, Clay Neal, Amrit, Sandu, and others have been key on helping us, so thanks to them as well. Proud to vote aye. So pass, that gets us to, can you please read the title for item number 201?
Authorize an agreement and memorandum of understanding with the Department of Treasury, Internal Revenue Service, Criminal Investigation to allow for reimbursement of city expenses.
So I just want to, the police bureau isn't as plentiful in the crowd today because they're kind of busy. But I'm willing to hold this over, or did folks get an opportunity to get their answers, the answers they sought?
Well, the police bureau reminded me I couldn't afford any more traffic tickets, so
okay.
I'm prepared to vote for this today.
All right.
Mayor, one thing I did learn, I think
what
that
the hell is that?
If we had someone here at the lectern, I would put into the record that there was some testimony last time that there was a fund that had been created from restitution or civil forfeiture fund, and had about $750,000. And I think there was some testimony that there were some expenditures from that fund outside of our budget process, which I had an occasion to talk to Jack Ram about, and he assured me that, in fact, funds in that account and like accounts are indeed subject to our budget process, that they are, that they may be funds that are unexpected and therefore not forecast, but they are otherwise subject to some kind of oversight. And I had a little heartburn, I think, like some of my colleagues, on that ambiguity. The funds This is not just a fund that's set up and can be spent for any reason. It is still subject to our oversight. So I was pleased with that clarification from the budget director and prepared to vote aye.
So, Commissioner Leonard, I thought you raised some good questions at the last hearing, and my chief of staff has been out for 2 weeks sick, so I haven't been as following up on this as much. Could you tell me what you understand? Because your question was, why are we only getting 15,000? Why is the whole position not getting funded?
So I did, in all seriousness, the police chief did meet with me and addressed for me the concerns I had about dedicating officers to a function that may not allow them to be used in other capacities. And he assured me that would not happen, that if, in fact, we approve this agreement, yes, we could get up to $15,000 back in overtime, but that these are officers that would work on these issues anyway and other issues, and they actually view it, as was testified last week, as additional resources that they get from the federal government to help them with investigations they would do anyway, and that it actually decreases the amount of staffing they have to dedicate to these kinds of cases. So I was assured that that we weren't tying up resources at a time we're going to be cutting from fire and police and 911 and parks and other general fund bureaus, but that, in fact, this will help supplement the work that we already do with federal resources. So I greatly appreciate him taking the time to explain that to me, notwithstanding my driving record. And
is it that bad?
It's pretty bad.
Okay.
These darn lights, photo lights right out here. I mean,
yeah, we just got new ones.
Everybody's nodding.
Yeah.
We just got new ones, and it's not that we have your license number programmed
wow.
in. No. Is there anyone that wishes to testify on this matter? Please call the vote.
We got Dan Handelman.
Oh, Dan Handelman.
Good morning, Mayor Adams and Commissioners. I'm Dan Handelman with Portland Cop Watch. I did testify about this last week, and I appreciate some of the clarification that came here, but I would like to remind the council that the other issue that we raised was the issue of how is this IRS task force going to be held accountable to the terms of the a resolution that says that they're going to follow Oregon laws, the 181 laws, so-called, that the Joint Terrorism Task Force also has to follow. Yeah, I understand the mayor sort of hinted last week that this task force might be used to go after criminal gang activity. So, in other words, it might be used on a pretext as opposed to perhaps suspicion of actual criminal behavior. And
that's not what I said.
I understand, but that was the hint of what you said.
No, that wasn't the hint of what I said.
Okay. I'm sorry, Mayor. I thought this was my testimony time. What I understood.
Not when you testify for me.
I see. Well, I'll just tell you how I interpreted it. And in any case, a task force like this could be used to go after people for a pretext reason that has nothing to do with criminal activity. It could have to do with their political, social, or religious behavior, unless it has some kind of oversight to make sure that that doesn't happen. That's what the concern is, and I didn't hear anything here today that says that kind of oversight is going to happen. So I'm repeating that testimony.
Thank you, sir. All right, Carla, can you please call the vote?
Fritz.
Well, I appreciate the input from Commissioner Fish and Commissioner Leonard. It's evidence of why we have five of us up here all working and thinking and looking out for the good of the public. And I appreciate Mayor Adams for bringing this forward. Aye.
Fish.
Aye.
Saltzman.
Well, I do appreciate the discussion we had last week and the clarifications that both Commissioner Fish and Commissioner Leonard have sought over the intervening week. And I do think Dan Handelman does raise some interesting issues about pretext issues, and this certainly isn't the first time the IRS, or I shouldn't say this isn't the first, I mean the IRS in the past has been used as a political tool, particularly during the Vietnam War with President Nixon, and people in our community were targeted. So I think it's a fair point, but I do have a lot of trust in our police to follow Oregon law and to not be overridden by their participation in this task force. Aye.
Leonard?
Aye.
Adams?
Well, hopefully my clarification of the misanalysis of the testifier was accurately contained in the record. Couldn't be further from the truth or the intention of what this is about. This is an important partnership that we have, and I appreciate the council's digging into it so that they feel assured about all aspects of it, and I appreciate their support. Aye. So approved. Can you please read the title for item number 202?
Create a local improvement district to construct street and stormwater improvements in the Northeast 112th Avenue and Mark Street Local Improvement District.
Mr. Abbey.
Good morning, council members, Carla and Tracy. I'm Andrew Abbey, Local Improvement District Administrator. Happy Leap Day. This is a continuation of the item that came before you on January 25th. We received no remonstrances against LID formation. I do have a correction that I would like council to entertain an amendment for. There is an extraneous sentence in finding number 3, so I just wanted to amend the ordinance to remove the third and final sentence in finding number 3 of the ordinance, and we have some property owners here to speak, and then the recommendation is to pass it to a second reading and approval next week.
Mayor, I move the amendment.
Second. It's been moved and seconded. The amendment so voiced by Andrew Abbey. Please call the vote on the amendment.
Fritz.
Thank you for your attention to detail. Aye.
Fish.
Aye.
Saltzman.
Aye.
Adams.
Aye. Amendment so approved. All right. How many people have signed up to testify?
I had a sign-up sheet, but I don't have any.
Anyone here to testify?
No remonstrances.
Okay, please call. Oh, this moves to second reading next week and further consideration by the City Council. Can you please read the title and call the vote for item number 203?
Vacate a portion of Southwest 46th Avenue and a portion of Southwest Florida Street, subject to certain conditions and reservations. Fritz?
Well, thank you to everybody who testified at the first reading and to city staff for working out. What I am very pleased with is I think it addresses some of the concerns of the Pedestrian Advisory Committee and Southwest Trails PDX. So it's been a long process for the church and for the community, and one that I think has come to a really good outcome. I very much appreciate everyone's willingness to be community-oriented and to look at the best, the common good, as was previously referenced. So thanks to staff as well. Aye.
Fish.
Aye.
Saltzman.
Well, I appreciate all the work everybody did to get to this point. I want to wish St. Luke well in their campaign, their capital campaign, to make some, improve their facility and make it more welcoming for and to serve more people, whether it's meals or faith. So congratulations and good luck. Aye.
Adams.
Well, I want to thank the council president for working on this in my absence at the last meeting. Thank you and other stakeholders for helping to make it happen. And I would just underscore what Commissioner Saltzman said. Thanks for your continuing service to the community. Aye. So approved. Can you please read the title for item number resolution 204?
Direct Office of Neighborhood Involvement and Portland Police Bureau to formally notify Oregon Liquor Control Commission of city's opposition to issuing liquor license to food cart area and authorize the city attorney's office to participate on behalf of the city of Portland.
Commissioner Amanda Fritz.
Thank you, Mayor. A couple of weeks ago, we had a hearing on the issue of issuing food liquor licenses to food carts, and one in particular. The council passed a resolution, which I then presented to the Oregon Liquor Control Commission 2 days later, and they indicated their intent to delay. They did not at that point indicate that they were going to do rulemaking, but that was our request. Subsequently, representatives from the Oregon Liquor Control Commission indicated that they are planning to move forward with a license for Cartlandia. So although I think the entire council...
Guidelines, right? With guidelines?
Teresa will go into what they are proposing. Although, for me, it's not particularly about that proposal. It's about the general principle, which still stands, which is that we should have rulemaking, which are enforceable, before any liquor licenses are issued for food carts. So this resolution states that even more clearly and also indicates that we are prepared to go to court, if necessary, to make sure that our citizens are kept safe And every week I hear from citizens about problems with liquor licenses and liquor establishments. And we are challenged with our budget, with potentially losing police officers. There are nine OLCC inspectors for the 6-county area, which is clearly inadequate. And we feel very strongly about this issue. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Teresa Marchetti of the Office of Neighborhood Involvement.
Thank you very much, Mayor Adams and Commissioners. I'm going to start just by outlining, we did receive the application for Cartlandia in late June of 2011. Our process is through collaboration. The licensing specialist, myself, and the licensing investigator evaluate all new applications that come into the city of Portland. At that point, the license investigator position was vacant, and staff entered as the default recommendation a favorable recommendation, which is statutorily the default, due to the vacancy and also because the application itself assumes a structure as the statutes assume a structure, and so it was quite ambiguous. Since then, we had several communications with the OLCC, and it was indicated that no license would be given to a food cart or food pod structure until an AG opinion was received, and we assumed then that standard guidelines would be adopted by the OLCC based on that opinion. It's been made clear at this point that no standard rules will be applied, at least before this application is considered by the OLCC. And this resolution recognizes now that we have a different environment in licensing than we had in June. And because of that fact, this license sets a precedent for all other food cart and food pot licenses in the city of Portland. We need those clear guidelines, as we discussed on February 8th. They just currently don't exist. Therefore, this resolution directs ONI and the Portland Police Bureau to inform the OLCC of council's concerns about this application through formal opposition.
And can you just go into the difference between rules and guidelines and the restrictions that might be proposed for this particular application?
Absolutely. The guidelines that we received from the Oregon Liquor Control Commission are basically their best practices. So what they would suggest that any licensee that was coming in with this type of model would follow. It is not enforceable. The Cartlandia application in particular has two components to it that they're recommending go forward. One is a voluntary control plan, which is voluntary measures that the licensee would abide by in the operation of the Cartlandia license that, again, are not enforceable but are the way that are would be what the OLCC and the licensee together have collaborated to come up with to mitigate some of the concerns. In addition to that, there are several license restrictions. And a restriction is a condition that's put on the license, that's put on the specific license, the violation of which is a Category 1 violation. It's a high violation. For that reason, it's very hard to sustain those restrictions, and a licensee can ask for at any time those restrictions to be lifted. Typically, we see those restrictions lifted within a year of a license being granted, and at that point, they can be lifted without notice to City Council, and they are also often lifted if there's no evidence of problems associated with the licensed premise. So in this situation, if we didn't have any problems at Cartlandia, which would be what we wanted, those restrictions could be taken away.
Can I ask a couple of questions? Going back to what you said at the beginning of your testimony, what are you doing now differently at ONI so there's no default mechanism that results in a letter issuing with an approval?
Well, the City of Portland forms have changed because of this. The licensing forms call out specifically what type of entity the person is applying to be licensed, whether it's a food cart or a food part entity as part of the operation. So that has changed at the City of Portland's process.
Who has to formally sign off just administratively on a yay or a nay within ONI on a liquor license application?
That would be me.
And does the director, you consult with the director or the commissioner or both when you make that determination?
We consult with the director, and then we consult with the Portland Police Bureau, and the official recommendation comes from the Portland Police Bureau.
Thank you. Now, the last discussion we had on this, council had some dialogue about the guidelines, and the best practices that you referred to are like that 2 or 3 page document that was furnished to us last time that has some general principles, but it is, I wouldn't call it, it's not like what we're used to seeing around rulemaking where there's specific things in the code. It appears to be more like suggestions or...
Correct.
And could you remind me, do the current best practices require that a food cart that sells alcohol have a restroom?
No, they do not. I don't believe so.
And, Mayor, subsequent to our discussion last week, I mean, I think I and probably my colleagues have received some emails from folks, and they are either emails saying positive things about Cartlandia or noting that what some people view as the positive impact of Cartlandia in its current location. And I think Commissioner Leonard said it more eloquently than I could last week, but this issue is not about Cartlandia's current operations. And I don't remember anyone here saying anything critical about their current site and the services that they're providing. The question is the introduction of alcohol to that location and doing so in a way without a comprehensive set of rules that could then be applied citywide, and whether we would do this on a case-by-case basis using each cart as a guinea pig, in effect, to see what the impact is, or whether we would step back and do some rulemaking so that there was some clear rules that applied that could be enforceable. And I think the record was clear last week, but to the extent someone still thinks that we're singling out Cartlandia, I didn't hear that last week when I was president and presiding officer. What I heard was people saying, in the absence of rules, we don't know how this is going to play out, and we have concerns about adding alcohol to that location. And I continue to have those concerns. And I think the other point I would make is that the Attorney General's decision says that because the OLCC is in the business of issuing licenses, and because they can set criteria, you have a right to a license if you follow the requisite criteria, if you meet the criteria. There's a little bit of a circular problem here, because right now our position, at least my position, is we don't have clear criteria other than the fitness of the applicant. And we have, I think, every reason to be concerned about the impact of this proliferation throughout the city, particularly in light of the limited resources to enforce the law. So I want to once again on the record note that we're not picking on I'm not, and no one of my colleagues were picking on Cartlandia last week. It's not a question of their current operations. It's a question of what happens if you introduce alcohol and then you have best practices and not guidelines, not clear guidelines and code, and what is the potential impact on the community? I think that's the question before us.
Absolutely. Commissioner Fritz?
So this is about the regulations. It's about the regulatory structure. Just one comment, though, on what your eloquence, Commissioner Fish. We actually haven't seen the Attorney General's opinion. What we have is the OLCC telling us what's in the AG's opinion. But when I asked the OLCC director if I could see it, he said, no, it's attorney-client privilege. So OLCC is making decisions based on an opinion which we haven't had the opportunity to look over. I think that's a problem also.
Commissioner Seltzman?
Well, the resolution... first paragraph says, express the city's opposition to issuing liquor license to food cart area, singular. Are we talking Cartlandia? Or is that a typo and should be food cart areas, plural?
Are you talking about the first whereas paragraph in the resolution?
No, the first paragraph of the resolution.
Should be plural.
Rex Oney, Police Bureau, notify OLCC. To opposition to issuing liquor license to food cart area.
It should be
singular.
Plural. Thank you for the correction.
Oh, so it should be plural.
Yes, thank you.
So this is not all directed at Cartlandia, then.
Unless there are objections, that'll be taken as a Scribner's error, so corrected.
And then I'm trying to get, I know there was a majority support, I guess last week, for banning beer, wine, liquor sales from food carts altogether. You know, I wasn't persuaded that that's necessarily, there isn't some meeting of the minds between that issue. So what are we authorizing the city attorney to do?
To represent the city's interest at the
OLCC. To ask them for issuing formal rules?
To provide guidance to ONI and PPB as we request rulemaking. And to your point, Commissioner Saltzman, about the meeting of the minds, there have been some licenses, some areas that are food cart pods that have sold alcohol under a temporary sales license. There's some movement to, as part of the whole package of looking at what type of guidelines might be appropriate for these types of entities, as to whether or not that would be the appropriate venue for allowing alcohol service. Because if there are problems, it's a much clearer, quicker way to a resolution than through an annual license process.
But so bottom line, I'm just, you know, there was a majority that supported the total ban, mm-hmm. and I respect that majority vote, even though I wasn't part of it. But so we're going down there we're authorizing our city attorney to say, OLCC, we want rules about this.
We're authorizing more.
And
the way I interpret it, we're authorizing more than that. We're authorizing the city attorney to determine what the interests are in majority of city council in terms of our charter responsibilities to try to keep the peace. And that, let me just tell you my personal approach to this, and that is that the underlying existing, separate from the possibility of 695 new liquor licenses, which is, I guess, the estimated number of food carts, on top of the 3,000 liquor licenses, roughly, that are in the city right now. So even before you get to beer and wine and your issues, is the underlying existing system, even without more liquor license to food carts, is a total failure as a system. You cannot have 9 people. How many liquor licenses are there in the 3-county area?
I'm not sure about that.
So you have 9 people who run around 3 counties who alone in the city of Portland are supposed to keep track of 3,000 liquor licenses. That's laughable. And so my intent is to allow the city attorney to pursue whatever we need to pursue to fix the existing system and to prevent the problem from getting worse. But other people can have their own interpretation.
But to get more to the point of Commissioner Saltzman's inquiry, I'm interpreting our action quite different from what he would like to have happen, that being that we oppose licensing not just Cartlandia, but food carts in general to have a liquor license in the city. Correct?
Yes.
And if that means that's not a unanimous vote here, that's what that means. But my intention in voting for this is directing the city attorney's office to work with the OLCC to not allow, under any conditions, alcohol to be served from food carts. I shouldn't say without any conditions, because there are instances where we, on the waterfront, where we have, I assume, what are defined as food carts that are there for festivals and events, and those are pre-prescribed. But in what we think of as food cart pods, traditionally, the ones downtown, this one, the one on 50th and Division, just south, I'm assuming that this applies to those kinds of food cart pods, and we would be working to make sure that liquor licenses, not just for Cartlandia, but for any of those sites, will not be approved.
Ben Wiltus from the City Attorney's Office.
Yeah, hear what Ben has to say.
Well,
for the record.
For the record, Ben Wiltus with the City Attorney's Office. I was monitoring the conversation from upstairs and thought it might be appropriate for me to come down. The under the city code, the city attorney's office is restricted from participating in legal proceedings unless the council has given an authorization by resolution. And so this addresses the code constraints on our ability to provide legal representation. That's the first intent of the language. So what's pending right now is an application from Cartlandia, and this follows, the resolution follows on the heels of the prior resolution in which the council took a position that in the context of the OLCC proceeding with issuing licenses, that we would ask the OLCC to hold off and initiate and conclude a rulemaking before going down the road of issuing licenses to Cartlandia or others in sort of an ad hoc approach with the guidelines and the weaknesses of guidelines that has been previously identified in the testimony. Given the fact that in that resolution, the council identified that the city should oppose any applications until such rulemaking has occurred, we had a gap where we had this one application pending, but had no formal position that we could identify and forward on to the OLCC in this particular instance. And so this manifests both the council's intent as to this particular application, in other words, asking the OLCC to hold off until a rulemaking proceeding has been undertaken, and also authorizing the city attorney's office to get involved and help out in terms of representation before the OLCC.
So, okay, I appreciate that. So I guess if the OLCC does do a rulemaking about this and the outcome provides an avenue for food pods or whatever to obtain a liquor license, are we authorizing you to sue the OLCC over those rules because they don't ban it?
That would be, could potentially be one of the outcomes of the council's decision today, depending on what the expression of the council's intent is in this proceeding.
So whatever direction we give you today, as opposed to you coming back to us at a point saying, okay, they've issued the rules, there is a path for food pods to obtain a liquor license, shall we sue?
That could be another outcome of today's discussion. If that would be the council's preference, then the council could put that in as guidelines to our office.
Well, I guess my preference would be that the city attorney's office come back to us at that point and seek our permission to formally...
Well, I'm in charge of this process, so I would certainly come back to you if, you know, depending on how things go, I will be continuing to communicate with you as to next steps.
I'm
not expecting the city attorney's office to, you know, appeal to the Supreme Court.
No, but, the whole point, as our city attorney just pointed out, is this resolution is necessary to permit the city attorney's office to have involvement. And I guess I would want another check-in point if rules, formal rules, are issued and we're not happy with them, I would like another check-in before we say go forth and sue.
In the context of this particular resolution, as drafted, the intent was that the representation would be as to this application and the outcomes of this application, not the rulemaking process. It was not intended to extend to the full rulemaking process. But again, it's up to the council to decide the scope of the authority. It sounds to me like at least one of the commissioners and the commissioner in charge would intend on coming back and checking in prior to going down that road.
Yeah, so. Commissioner Saltzman, I'm happy to commit to come back as many times as we need to. We need to highlight the challenges that we're facing and the reasons for taking each step. So, yes, I will certainly come back to council.
So in other words, you would come back to council via resolution if we're going to go the step of saying, if we're unhappy with the rules with respect to the ban. But
yes, I'd be happy because it's
formally authorized the city attorney to go forth and sue.
I thought we were pretty clear 2 weeks ago, and OLCC has chosen a different route. So the more clear we can be and the number of times it has to come back to council, I'm happy to commit to that, yes.
Well, I would hope sooner rather than later that we make a clear statement. I mean, I'm not in charge of the Office of Neighborhood Involvement, but I would hope that we make a, if this is not clear, a clearer statement that on behalf of neighborhoods that we object to outdoor drinking where it abuts neighborhoods.